This is The Forgetting.
What's keeping me in the game are my faith, hope, and humor. But now it's getting harder now, David. I'm getting more and more exhausted, and at times more and more confused. People want to see a train wreck, okay? They want a crisis before they do anything, and I think that's true of Alzheimer's. And you could ask my wife, we're just talking about it. She cries a lot. She sees the train wreck. My kids see the train wreck. People close to me see the train wreck. There was one good time. I almost got in trouble, but I went up and hugged and kissed this gorgeous girl because I thought I knew her. But she was okay with it. So that was made me feel okay. Well, maybe I still got it.
From WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Argo Studios on West 26th Street in New York City, this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me is my friend and co-host, Greg O'Brien, author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Greg, how are you?
Hey, David.
Good to talk to you again.
How you doing? Good to see you. I guess I can't see you, but you look good.
It's the best way to see me, trust me.
It's a word picture. It's a word picture I got.
Right. How's your day today? How are you feeling? Is today a good day or a not so good day?
Well, it's a little confusing because I got confused on when I was supposed to be here, so that was a little confusing. But I guess we can say anything on this show, right?
Absolutely.
Is all right with you? So, on this disease, you lose a lot of control and. One of the things you lose control of, continents. And maybe not a good way to start this show out if it particularly airs on at lunchtime, but I had to stop and meet with someone beforehand. And what happens in Alzheimer's is just without notice, like the light goes off in your brain, things just shut down. I don't know the best way to say it is I lost control of, I urinated without having control, and I had to go in and see someone that I'm working with. And these are the kinds of things that, and this just happened, David, like a half hour ago. Mm-hmm. And these are the kinds of things that people with early onset have to deal with who are still working. So I was late in typical fashion, and I had to put my laptop down to, kind of cover that area. And I walked in and made eye contact with the person. And then I went out in the car and, I always keep another pair of pants and had to change, but I'm in the men's room changing and it just pisses you off. If I could say that word, I mean, it's another example of what you're losing and it's not cool to have that happen. You feel like you're going back to the cradle,
And right. And I assume there's also some shame and embarrassment associated with that.
Oh God,
but I wonder if you're kind of getting used to that.
David, it's just very embarrassing, and then you have to focus on what you're supposed to do, and you got to get out of the room without anyone knowing, and you wonder if they suspect anything, and you got to focus and. It struck me that that's a good example of a lot of the people with early onset Alzheimer's who are dealing in the early stages with this.
So, I mean, the good news, Greg, to take a 30,000 foot view of this is that you're still really self-conscious of that sort of thing because eventually in the disease, you won't be so self-conscious about an episode like that for terrible reasons, you know, because of the advance of the disease. But you're still as self-conscious about something like that happening as it would if it happened to me or anyone else. Most of your brain is actually still working pretty darn well. And you also have the shame that's, you know, the appropriate amount of shame and embarrassment. It's not like you're feeling some crazy other emotion that wouldn't be associated with that.
Right. So it is, but it's, and I've talked to a lot of people with early onset, you're dealing with the shame of it. And, you know, in a lot of speeches I give, I tell people exactly that. There's going to, as with my mother, because the same thing would happen to my mother. But there come a time when I don't know. And I know this sounds odd to say, but I think people with early onset who are going through that wish at times that they get to the point where they don't remember, because it's not fun to remember.
Right. So emotionally,
does that make any sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've talked about this before. I think we even talked about it a bit in the last episode. But certainly you and I have talked about this as friends, that you have an ambivalence, that you go back and forth sometimes wanting to just really kind of fight every aspect of this disease, and sometimes wanting to give in and not even be so aware of and not be living with it as consciously as you are.
In my training as a journalist, and I was like this as a athlete. You play with the hurts. I played baseball and football in high school and college, and people want to see a train wreck. Okay, they want a crisis before they do anything, and I think that's true of Alzheimer's. And you could ask my wife, we're just talking about it. She cries a lot. She sees the train wreck. My kids see the train wreck. People close to me see the train wreck. But if I publicly show a bunch of people when I'm trying to make a point about this disease, the train wreck, it gets them off point because they want to just say, oh, I feel sorry for you, and that makes them feel good. But they're not listening to what I have to say, which is, you can learn to live with this disease, but you got to fight, and you got to have people to fight with you, and you got to have a Congress to fight with you. And, you know, I think in fighting this disease, you know, you see a lot of the train wreck, and I think that's important for people to understand, but I think more important is to get the message across, and that's what you're doing, and that's why I'm honored to be part of this podcast.
Oh, the honor is all mine. But you know,
does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And the disease works. It was once said to me, and you're very schooled in this, that Alzheimer's are like snowflakes. They're, you know, all different patterns. And so, you know, there are times when, and it's happening more and more, people that I know, I mean, I'll be in a room and with people I've known all my life, and I might recognize 20% of them, and I know they know me because I could tell by their body language. So rather than embarrass them, I pretend like I know them. But a lot of them know better, and they come up, which is really cool, and they hug me, and they say, this is Joe or this is Jane. And you know what? That makes me feel really good as opposed to being embarrassing because they know. And there are times when in the brain, and again, you're a lot smarter than me, so you would know this, but my mind, what's the best way to say it here? My mind paints faces on other people so it looks familiar to me. And this has happened, and I wrote about it in my book, and it's happening more and more now, where I go up and I engage people, and my body language is, I've known you all my life, and I realize, a minute into the conversation, I've never met this person before.
Hmm.
There was one good time, I almost got in trouble, but I went up and hugged and kissed this gorgeous girl because I thought I knew her. And she, but it was, you know, it, it, you know, it was, but she was okay with it. So that was, made me feel okay, well, maybe I still got it.
Maybe your wife wasn't so happy about that.
No, no. Well, we're not going to tell her. Well, maybe it's too late for that. Another thing, Dave, and I'm finding now that there are things that race through my head, and I just forgot what I was going to say, but my short-term memory, and you've heard me say this before, 60% of it can be gone in 30 seconds, but even more and more, it's just like boom, boom, boom. You have a thought, it's gone. You have a thought, it's gone. You have a thought, it's gone. And so what I'm doing now, and a lot of people are noticing it, but I've kind of apologized for it. I'll blurt things out that I think are important when I can't write them down because I want to say it. Mm. And then it's lost forever. And when that happens, I get angry and, you know, I carpet bomb F-bombs, and that's not good. But I'm noticing the rage more and more. And for the first time, you know, I've started the discussion with my wife, when do I start to let go? Because what's keeping me in the game are my faith, hope, and humor. But now it's getting harder now, David. I'm getting more and more exhausted and at times more and more confused. And I'm saying, okay, you know, when do I take myself out of the game?
Hey, Rudy.
Hey.
Let me read some of the exalted things about you first, and then we'll dive in. And I know you'll be embarrassed by this, but Dr. Rudolph Tanzi is the Joseph P. and Rose F. Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard University. You've heard of that. He is also Vice Chair of Neurology Research and Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. And this year, 2015, he is on Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. I'm pretty sure I was 101 and just barely didn't make it. So there's a little bit of bitterness there. Thank you for giving us a little time today, Rudy.
My pleasure, of course.
I kind of cut off the very long list of things that the contributions you've made to Alzheimer's, and I thought maybe the best way to start would be to ask you, what are you most proud of all of your contributions over the many years to date? Is there one thing that kind of sticks out as being an accomplishment, a discovery you're most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to say it still goes back to summer of 1986, when, as a student at Harvard, you know, I first discovered this gene that we named amyloid precursor protein, because it's the gene that makes the amyloid that makes up the plaques in Alzheimer's, and it's still the number one drug target today for, you know, for therapies of treating or preventing the disease. And, you know, it's been 30 years now almost, and there was so much controversy over whether that was the right target. Is that the right gene to target? Is amyloid the right thing to target? And I won't go through the whole reason for the roller coaster ride, but just over the last year, I guess the second discovery would be what we call Alzheimer's in a dish, because when we were finally able to use human stem cell derived nerve cells and grow them in a mini brain in a dish, and for the first time really model this disease correctly with human nerve cells rather than in mice, we also got the validation that, yes, amyloid is the best target. That's what you want to hit. And it came full circle to that first gene we found 30 years ago. So I think those would be the two that really stand out, which was the first one and now the latest one.
Yeah, that's a really nice way to bookend the discussion of what's going on and what's happened in Alzheimer's research over this, basically the course of your career, is that we've had a lot of good ideas. There were some early discoveries, yours and a few others, real early on, and there was this theory that amyloid was kind of coming first and then causing the creation of the tau tangles, which then in turn were doing the serious damage to the brain. But now, with this very recent discovery of yours, that theory has been, can we say, validated?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I think, you know, I was at a meeting among pretty top Alzheimer's researchers yesterday in New York, part of a consortium. And you know, and we were talking about this, and we said, you know, isn't it nice to know that we don't have to fight about it anymore? It's not amyloid plaques or tangles. Now we know it's both. And we know that what Alzheimer's is a disease where amyloid accumulation in the brain is plaques and other forms of amyloid cause tangles to form in nerve cells, and those nerve cells die. And as those nerve cells start to die, they cause inflammation. And amyloid itself directly causes inflammation. And so, you know, we have our marching orders. Stop the amyloid early. Stop those tangles as early as you can because they can start to spread like a fire. But for patients who have this disease right now, if we want to help them, you need to stop the inflammation. And I still believe if we had a magical drug right now that could, I like to say, chill the brain out and stop that inflammation, I think we could help patients who are suffering from this disease right now where the amyloid and the tangles have already done most of their work to get you to the point where it's mainly inflammation.
Hey, Rudy, this is Greg. Just in layman's terms, because all I did in high school was cut up a frog, so what does inflammation do in Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so inflammation is the brain's, it's the way the brain defends itself. So that sounds kind of funny, given this, the way the brain's hurting itself in Alzheimer's. You have in your brain nerve cells that form your neurocircuitry and, you know, allow you to function and think and have cognition and move, et cetera. But then there are all these supporting cells that help the nerve cells out, and they're called glia. That's the general name for them. And glia in Greek means glue, because in the beginning, folks thought that glia just literally glued the nerve cells together and held them in place. But now we know that these glial cells, normally they're housekeeping, they're cleaning stuff up, they're providing growth nutrients for the nerve cells. They're all around, you know, nursemaids, housekeepers, etc. But when they see a lot of nerve cells dying around them, they make a very primitive assumption. If nerve cells are dying, there must be something wrong, maybe a virus or a bacteria or something invading the brain. And so instead of being housekeepers, they turn into soldiers trying to defend the brain. And in doing so, there's collateral damage, there's friendly fire. So these helper cells are trying to defend the brain, and as they're shooting out these bullets made of oxygen called free radicals, they're oxygen-based bullets, and they're causing other cells called astrocytes to get all excited. To a large extent, in a patient who has the disease right now, it's that friendly fire that's the problem. And if we can stop that, we believe that we can really help patients who have the disease right now, because we've seen autopsies of people, you know, where people died in the 80s, 90s, or 100, and every once in a while you'll see a brain in an autopsy, and it's full of plaques and tangles. And you're saying, well, wait, how could this person be 90 years old? There was no cognitive problems. They have as many plaques and tangles as an Alzheimer's patient. We call those resilient brains. And what do they have in common? The resilient brains had no inflammation. So that's why we think that you can live with a lot of these plaques and tangles if you stop the response against them and the response against the nerve cell death they cause, which is the inflammatory process or neuroinflammation. So we're working very, very, you know, diligently on that right now.
There's really three different tactics. You know, if you look at the overall strategy that we're forming to try to stop the disease, is it too crude to say there are really three different kind of targets that we have, trying to stop the disease early by preventing the formation of the amyloid plaques. We have trying to stop the amyloid plaques from them prompting these tangles, these terrible tangles to form. And then you've got later on in the disease trying to stop a different tactic, which is trying to stop that inflammatory process. And that's really three very separate things in terms of coming up with drugs to actually slow down or stop the disease. Is that right?
Yeah, that's very accurate. And I would just add on the tangle side that you also can try to stop those tangles from spreading, because, you know, it's kind of like amyloid lights the match, and then the tangles become the fire because it spreads. Like you can have a tangle leak out of a dying nerve cell and infect a healthy nerve cell. So there are also therapies aimed at stopping the tangle from spreading. But, you know, President Obama talked about precision medicine and right patient, right drug, but as importantly, or maybe more importantly, is right patient, right drug, right time. You have to treat the right stage of the disease. And, you know, Alzheimer's disease doesn't begin when a patient has cognitive problems. Alzheimer's disease actually begins, you know, 15 years before any cognitive problems, when this pathology is accumulating in the brain. Just like cancer doesn't begin when someone is in bed in pain with organ failure. It began when a tumor started to form and there were no symptoms. We don't think of Alzheimer's like that, but medically and scientifically, we have to start thinking about it this way if we're going to nip it in the bud.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. That was on my list because you gave this really interesting talk at the Cure Alzheimer's Fund Symposium about a month ago. And you made that point, and you and I talked afterward about that being something that we work on together, that we really need to help people change the mindset of Alzheimer's because it's so associated, the disease is so associated with the symptoms of the disease, which don't actually occur until fairly late in the disease. The disease itself actually starts, I think you just said 15 years before, but really it can be decades before if we're talking about the first emergence of that amyloid, right?
Yes, it could be 20. It could be up to 20 years, at least up to 20 years before. So, it's a different way of looking at the disease. Now, it's important for people to know that this is not just a disease that suddenly strikes someone who's very old. That even if someone gets it when they're older, like at 85 years old, the disease began in them, you know, probably back when they were as early as 60 years old, and that there are those who are listening right now who are in their 40s and may already have this pathology accumulating faster than it should. All of us accumulate this pathology over 40 years old with a few, you know, exceptions of genetically lucky mutants. But, you know, all of us do. And the question is, you know, how fast is it accumulating and when is it going to get to the point that inflammation pushes you down that slippery slope? So I think about those plaques and tangles pushing you up the mountain. You can sit on top of that mountain for a while, but it's inflammation that throws you down off the mountain and down that slippery slope to dementia.
What you just said, Rudy, is just so key. Often when I give my speeches, I say that Alzheimer's is not your grandfather's disease. And then I say, sure, my maternal grandfather died of Alzheimer's, my mother, my uncle, and my father had dementia. But as you point out, for people to understand it and to take it seriously, the symptoms can start or the disease itself can start 20 years earlier. And until we understand that as a nation, we're just going to think that it's just a disease that, you know, you're going to die anyway, so you died of Alzheimer's, and so why spend any money on it because you were going to die? That there are people, you know, my age and younger, who every day have to try to go to work and fight with these symptoms. And so it's good that you do that.
You know, I would love to talk for a minute about the process of what you do, Rudy, because it's fascinating to listen to you. And it's, as Greg said, it's great that you can bring it down to the level of, you know, of anyone. You don't have to have any really technical understanding of science. And that's really nice in the metaphors you use. And also, you're just a nice guy and you're fun to talk to. So that's also nice. But what people may not know, they may have, I think they, you know, if when they form an image of you working in a lab, wearing a lab coat, they've probably seen a picture of you with a lab coat, and they may have seen you with colleagues, and you often talk about colleagues. But I think what people don't realize that I do, because I've been able to watch you work in the lab and see you at some of these great meetings, is you're really, your work is all in the context of all these other really interesting minds, and that what makes you special is that you're one of the leaders of this community of really fascinating and wonderful scientists. Some of them actually work for you, and I've seen you sit around a table and kind of listen to what they're finding and then direct them to their, you know, to the next stage of their research. But then on a bigger level, you're having meetings constantly all over the country, all over the world, where you're sitting around and you're reporting the very latest and what you're finding well before it's published, because you need to, you know, you need to cross your I's and dot your I's and cross your T's before you do that. But reporting to them what you're finding and how it adds just a little bit to this question, and is there someone out there who can then report to you on what they found, which either disputes that or which builds on that, and how can you find yet another scientist to do an experiment which answers this brand new question that you just came up with that you didn't even realize you had before? So I mean, that to me is fascinating, but I think it's really important that people understand how this collaboration is just a constant and so such a key part of this process.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head, and that and there's different levels, right? So it always takes a village, so to speak. And what you have is that in my own lab, you know, there are people with different expertises, some at the bench, some at the computer, you know, some in the wet lab, some working, as we say, in silico, meaning analyzing data. I'm really getting, you know, at the bench doing wet lab stuff, because it's almost like basketball, you know, younger people have better hands. You know, so at some point, you don't do the physical stuff at the bench anymore, because there are younger people who do it better. But you become the coach, you become the manager, you're calling the plays, you're analyzing the data, you know, and running the show. And so you do that at the level of the lab. We do that at the level of our unit of multiple labs working on Alzheimer's, from genetics to cell biology to biochemistry, drug discovery, but you also do it at the level of consortia, right, where we have the Cure Alzheimer's Fund consortium of top-notch Alzheimer's researchers. And I think the last part of it is, you don't want to just have Alzheimer's researchers, you want to have basic scientists who may not know much about Alzheimer's disease, but know a lot about a certain gene or protein or neuro pathway that has been implicated in your research. And you say, let's get a card-carrying expert who knows all about this gene we just found is an Alzheimer's-related gene, but we don't know what this gene does. So it really takes all kinds, but it's very important to have the direction up top, and paying attention to the granularity, but also to the big vision. And that's what I like to think I do. And I'm really lucky, because I have really good people who I work with, really smart people. But on the other hand, I really try to look for smart people and surround myself with them. So a lot of it's who we surround ourselves with, and probably more than anything else.
We'll have to do this again, Rudy, because there's obviously so much more we can talk about. But thanks for taking the time today. And and another time we'll talk about funding, which is just such a dire problem, and you're one of the best funded scientists I think there is in the country, and yet you're barely touching what you could be doing. You know, funding is such the bottleneck here, and that's a real tragedy that we need to constantly remind the public about. But on that kind of down note, thanks again for taking the time today, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thank you, Rudy. Yeah. God bless you.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks, David. I look forward to speaking again. We can pick up where we left off. That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Okay, thanks.
That is it for our show today. Greg and I want to thank our colleagues at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, especially our guest today, Dr. Rudy Tanzi, chair of its International Research Consortium. In between his breakthrough discoveries in Alzheimer's, Rudy composed and performed our theme music. I have also seen him levitate 2 feet off the ground. Noriko Okabe is my engineer here at Argo Studios in New York City. At WCAI in Woods Hole, the engineer is Dan Tridle. Thank you, Dan. Forgetting is a co-production of WCAI and myself. My co-producer is Sean Corcoran. And Greg, I have to remind you, you still owe me $100, so...
I'm going to Xerox it to you.
That's a deal. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, thank you.